In February of 1980, we had the great underdog story. In fact, it's even sometimes referred to as the Miracle on Ice. We had the young American hockey team that was basically recruited from collegiate level, playing against the well-seasoned Russian force. It's a great movie, by the way. I think it's been told in movies about twice or three times. And so you have this very seasoned professional team that had played together for several years, had even won some Olympics before, and then here comes the team nobody expects to do anything. And what happens? They beat them. We love stories like that, don't we? We love David and Goliath stories. Folks, that's what's happening in 1 Samuel 17. It is the David and Goliath story. It is the prime example of what it means when an individual goes against somebody who they should never have a chance against. Somebody that should be able to grind them into the dust, and yet what they do is overcome. I know we know the story. I know we're familiar with the story. We're going to read a lot of the text tonight. I don't apologize for that. I think it's important because what we have done too often is talked about certain facets of this story without really thinking about the demands, the implications of this story. So let's look a little bit further here. In verse 4, a champion went out from the camp of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a bronze helmet on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. He had a bronze armor on his legs and a bronze javelin between his shoulders. Now the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his iron spearhead weighed 600 shekels, and a shield bearer went before him. Then he stood and cried out to the armies of Israel, and he said to them, "Why have you come out to line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine and you the servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. We read that and we think, yeah, they were greatly afraid. But do you think they had fought formidable foes before? Sure they had. Folks, Israel at this time in history was known for its warfare. That wouldn't actually change for another 40 to 50 years because that's one of the reasons why David was not allowed to build the temple. Do you remember? "David, you've shed too much blood to build my temple. It's going to be Solomon who does it." Folks, war was part of Israel's history. War was part of their life. And yet here they are on the field of battle, on this valley. On one side is Philistines. On one side is Israel. And in the middle, this great chasm where they're afraid. They're afraid to fight. And of course we read, his armor 6,000 shekels. I know everybody's thinking, oh, I know exactly how much that is. Oh, yeah, yeah. I weigh like 4,500 shekels. Actually, 4,525 shekels. I'm kidding. I made that up entirely. I have no idea. But by best estimates, his armor weighed about 90 pounds. His spearhead weighed about 15 pounds. The head on the end of his spear weighed 15 pounds. Now we think, wow, how large was a man? How large was this man? Well, you know, best estimates, we know this, about 9'6". Do you realize what 9'6" really is? So, just to consider a few things, the average man, and let's just say the average age of David, we're going to find out in a moment, he is a youth. We don't really know what that means. Best guesses is between 14 and 20. Everything about this story makes you think David is between the ages of 14 and 20. That's beyond the language in Hebrew. He's between 14 and 20. He's not a big man. He's a young man. Now, if you're thinking, well, he's maybe a tall man. Folks, Israel men didn't grow up to be as tall as most of the men we are around today. I would be tall for an Israelite. That's just the way that works, generally speaking. In fact, if we were to put weight to weight, I'm probably a little heavier than most Israelite men would be. They're not big-framed men. They're not big southern boys fed on corn. They're Israelites, fed in the north or fed in the Middle Eastern world. And so if David is 5'2", and that middle picture there would be about the size of Shaq, Shaquille O'Neal, Shaq weighs 324 pounds as playing weight. 324 pounds, and he's 7'1". Now, I've met a few people over 7 foot. I met Sean Bradley, and I think if I remember right, 7'6". One of the tallest players to ever play in the NBA. I've met him. And it is something to see a man who's 7'6". You recognize 7'6" is nothing compared to 9'6". 24 inches of difference. 2 feet taller. Now this is the element of this discussion that we're not really typical to think about. If you've seen a man who's 7'6", generally the way their body is built, they're thin as a rail. If you've seen a picture of Sean Bradley or Yao Ming or some of these very tall players that played center in the NBA, they're generally 7'3", 7'7", and they're this big around. They turn sideways and you can't see them, unless they're chewing gum and blowing bubbles. And they're just little bitty men. They're just tall. You recognize that's not the way Saul would have been built. You recognize that's not how Shaquille O'Neal's built. Shaq is a man who is built proportionate to his height. You know that. 324 pounds playing weight. He ain't weighing 324 today. That's a big man. How heavy do you think Goliath must have been? When his armor weighs 90 pounds, you recognize it wasn't one of these things where it's, let me just pick up this really heavy item and I'll pick it up this one time and it's really no big deal after that. Folks, this is armor he intends on wearing the entire day in the battlefield. And it's not as if he goes into the battlefield at 9 a.m. and he clicks the clock and then he hears the dinner bell at around noon and he takes a break. And then at around 5 o'clock, the end of the day whistle blows, and he gets to come off the battlefield. Folks, this is a suit of armor he's going to wear all day long. So he's big enough to carry a 90-pound armor breastplate all day long in the field of battle. You think about the size of that spear. I used to play a really dumb game when I was a boy. Okay, when I was older than a boy, when I was a teenager. Play with a sledgehammer. And if you played with a sledgehammer, if you're around men for very long, you play the game. Let's see if we can hold the sledgehammer out at arm's length and tilt it down and touch your nose and pull it back up. And don't act like men sitting here like, oh, I've never played that in my life. Whatever. You know, and you've probably seen it done. It's a foolish game and it never plays out very well. You recognize that's a 3 or 4 or 5 pound sledgehammer. And you're holding it here. Now imagine a man big enough to carry a spear into battle with a head on it that weighs 15 pounds. And he's going to hold it out away from him. He's going to actually have it where he can use it all day long. I'll tell you what, you swing a 5-pound sledgehammer for a couple hours and you're tired. Imagine a man like Goliath who swings this thing all day long. In fact, there was a couple of reconstructions of this particular spear. And I want you to see this, because I think it's important for us to kind of get a visual image in our mind. These are two men, I don't know who they are, two men holding a replica spear. Again, you don't think about it all if you're not careful, but a 15-pound head, you're not putting that on a broomstick. That's going to be on a much bigger piece of lumber that it can support it the entire time all day long. It's built to kill people and keep killing people all day long. Imagine the hands on this man. He's able to grab this thing up and wield it like it's nothing. The average sword weighs 2 to 4 pounds. Did you know that? The spearhead alone is 3 to 4 times the size of an average sword. Now you think, well, that's not that impressive to me. Well, it should be. It should be because of what happens in 1 Samuel 17. Here's this man who wields a spear bigger than two men. And he does it all day long. Again, you just take a moment and think about if this man is built proportionate. If he's standing as just a proportionately built man, we're going to find out in just a moment, verse 33, when Saul is looking over David and thinking, wow, David, you're wanting to go out there. And Saul says, David, you're but a youth, and this man has been a man of war since his youth. So don't picture this scrawny individual who just happens to be 9'6" and he's super tall. This is a man who's built to intimidate others. I was given some consideration to this point, thinking, you realize this is probably one of the most deadly men to ever walk the face of the earth? How many men have you seen who's 9'6"? There's a few giants in the Bible. You've got Og, king of Bashan. But folks, Goliath, the champion of the Philistines, there were few men to ever walk the face of the earth as big as he was. So I did some estimates. If he's built proportionate at 9'6", he probably weighs in the neighborhood of 600 to 700 pounds. If he's in decent shape, 600 to 700 pounds when he walks onto the battlefield. You do recognize there's a reason every person in the story is scared to go out there. Don't forget, folks, that Saul is actually the man who's set up in this chapter to be the hero. Saul should be the man on the battlefield. Saul should be the champion of God's army who goes out and takes care of this, because Saul, in 1 Samuel 9 and verse 2, is said to be a head taller than every man in Israel. You remember that description? That means Saul was built like a man of war. Saul was a big individual. He looked like a king. If he's a head taller than everybody, that means he's only a couple of feet shorter than Goliath. If anybody should have went on the field, it should have been him, and yet that's not who goes, is it? Nowhere in this chapter do we read about horses. And in history, the army who had the chariots was the army who had the advantage. The army who had the horseback riders had the advantage on the field. And we do read about other occasions where there were horses used or there were chariots used. And I want you to get this in your mind. I'm not saying there were horses in this chapter, but I want you to understand how formidable a foe Goliath really, truly was. That's an old picture of my grandfather and me, and actually Bonnie. What you and I don't think about, because we're just not able to picture a man this large, is that when he walks onto the battlefield, if you're riding an Arabian-type breed horse, which would have been the typical horse of the Middle East, you're still looking up into his eyes. Do you get what I just said? So you think, I've got the advantage, I'm on horseback. Not when Goliath's on the battlefield, folks. You're still looking up into his eyes. And just so we're clear, a horse that's 600-700 pounds with a rider that's 150 pounds standing broadside with a man over here who's 700 pounds in battle weight knocks the horse over like it's nothing. You don't think he could do it with his spear? The spearhead weighs 15 pounds. Just getting hit by a blunt object that weighs 15 pounds would kill you. Folks, there's a reason these men are terrified of what they're facing. There's a reason they're scared to death of who's across the field. And there's a reason his voice trembles through Israel. You very rarely find a man that large who speaks a little like this. You know what I mean? You get a man like this across the battlefield, and he's challenging Israel. And he's saying, send someone out. And the exact phrase in verse 10, he says, I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. You think when he shouts that across the battlefield, it doesn't send little tremors over every man's neck? This is the scene in which David shows up. In verse 12, David was the son of the Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse. This is verse 12. Who had eight sons, and the man was old, advanced in years in the days of Saul. The three oldest sons of Jesse had gone to follow Saul to the battle. In verse 14, it says, David was the youngest, the three older having followed Saul. In verse 15, David occasionally went and returned from Saul to feed to his father's sheep at Bethlehem. Verse 16, the Philistine drew near and presented himself 40 days, morning and evening. You know what he just said? He said, morning and evening, this man, this giant named Goliath, goes out onto the battlefield and makes the same challenge. Morning and evening, and nobody will come out and face him. Nobody. But you see what Samuel is doing, the writer? In verse 17, Jesse says to David, go and see your brothers. In verse 19, all the men of Israel, the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah, fighting with the Philistines. In verse 20 and following, David then goes and meets them as he is supposed to. Notice verse 23. Then as he talked with them, there was the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, coming up from the armies of the Philistines, and he spoke according to the same word. So David heard them. And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him, were dreadfully afraid. So the men of Israel said, have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel, and it shall be that the man who kills him, the king will enrich with great riches and will give him his daughter and give his father's house exemption from taxes in Israel. And then David spoke to the men who stood by him, saying, what shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach of Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? You know, several times in this scene, we're being told the men of Saul, the men of Saul, the men of Saul. But who does David say they belong to? The living God. In verse 27 and following, you've got this brief interaction between the people and David. In verse 28, you've got Eliab and the brothers who are taunting David and accusing him of coming there just to simply be a nuisance in some respects. But notice verse 29. David then said, what have I done now? Is there not a cause? Then he turned from him toward another and said the same thing. And these people answered him as the same as the first ones did. And when the words which David spoke were heard, they reported them to Saul. And Saul sent for David. Then David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine. You think about what he just said. David said, I'll go and do it. Nobody else wants to? I'll take care of this problem, this nuisance, because he's defying the armies of the living God. That needs to be addressed. You can appreciate Saul's hesitancy in this whole situation. In verse 33, Saul said to David, you're not able to go up against this Philistine to fight with him. You are a youth, and he is a man of war since his youth. But notice what David says. Your servant used to keep his father's sheep, and when a lion or bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, I went out after it, and I struck it, and delivered the lamb from its mouth. And when it arose against me, I caught it by its beard and struck and killed it. Your servant has killed both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing he has defied the armies of the living God. Moreover, David said, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. And so Saul said to him, go and the Lord be with you. There's many points we're going to make from this in just a moment. I just want you to just take a moment and think about what we just read. Do you see any hesitation in David? Why? This is a man who is almost twice his height. If he's on the closer end to 5 foot, and Goliath is around that 9.5 feet, they're very close to twice his size. Some of the depictions in the children's stories almost look too fantastic. But you realize that they may be very accurate. A young man who comes up to no more than Goliath's belly button. What's going to happen when he gets up beside Goliath and Goliath just decides to take his two-plate or three-plate hands and just pop him on top of the head? How many times had Goliath done that before? There was a reason this man was the champion of Philistines. And this is a shepherd boy. A shepherd boy. And he tells Saul, the king of Israel, everybody else is afraid to go. I'll go. And I'll take care of him just like I took care of the lion and just like I took care of the bear. I can't imagine fighting a lion or a bear. Oh my.
But David did. Keep reading. In verse 40 and following, verse 38 and through verse 39, David, we get an indication of his size here. So while we can't know for sure how old he is, we can certainly tell that he's small in stature because he can't even hold up Saul's armor. Saul's armor, not Goliath's, Saul's armor. Saul puts his armor on him. You want to go fight the king's battle? You get to wear the king's stuff. So here you go, David. And David can't do it. He can't take those things and go out onto the battlefield because he's too small. And so what does he do instead? Well, he takes up the old sling. He picks up the 5 smooth stones from the brook. He puts them in his pouch and draws near to the Philistine. Look at verse 41. So the Philistine came and began drawing near to David, and the man who bore the shield went before him. When the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him, for he was only a youth, ruddy and good looking. So the Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you would come to me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, "Come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field." And then David said to the Philistine, get this. You think, wow, that story can't get any better. Yeah, it can. David then says to the Philistine, verse 45, "You came to me with a sword, with a spear, and with a javelin. But I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you, and I will take your head from you. And this day I will give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. Then all this assembly shall know that the Lord does not save with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and He will give you into our hands." What happens next? Exactly what David said would happen. This young man takes a sling. He takes a rock. And he spins it around and hits a man in the forehead who's over 9 feet tall and weighs north of 600 or 700 pounds. And when the man goes down, because David didn't even take a sword onto the battlefield, he takes that man's sword and cuts his own head off with it. Folks, this is the David and Goliath story for a reason. This is the original. There's a reason we sing there's a reason we know this story. There's a reason we think about this all the time. There's a reason we see some of the parallels in other places, because it truly is that awesome. Now in verse 48 and following, the Philistines, they arose and came and drew near to meet David, and David hurried and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. Verse 49, David put out his hand from his bag and he takes the stone, he slings it, struck the Philistine in his forehead so that the stone sank into his forehead and he fell on his face to the earth. As he prevails over the champion of the Philistines, notice what they do halfway through verse 51. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. They want to get out of Dodge, because they just saw their greatest warrior collapse from a shepherd boy in Israel who simply stood up because this man had defied the army of the living God. Man, what do you do with that? A shepherd boy who approaches this man in the valley of Elah and looks down one of the greatest warriors to ever walk the face of the earth, and he goes up against him with apparently no armor to speak of and a sling. I've got a few applications, just kind of an overall I want us to see. I want us to see from this text, okay? And we'll get through this rather quickly. Number one, young people can and should serve God. I'm going to tell you something, folks. It ought to impress you that 3,000 years later, we're still talking about, by all accounts, a teenage boy. His name is David. There's a lot of reasons why we talk about David. All of them generally are messianic in nature. But folks, he was a boy. Shame on us if we're not going to encourage our kids to serve the Lord. I'm not saying brainwash them. I'm not saying manipulate. I'm saying encourage. David went toe-to-toe with Goliath. What happened after that? Was Israel sitting on the sidelines? We were kind of afraid to go out there still. No. Next few verses describe how Israel took out after the Philistines. When they saw that their champion had died, the Philistines scattered. And what did Israel do? You're not going to run. We got you now, buddy. Teenagers, kids, can have a profound effect, a profound impact on how others serve God around them. Young people, you need to think about your influence. Yes, you need to think about peer pressure. You need to think about your influence at school and all those things too. But I want you to think about your influence here. Because you have one. You have one. What are you doing with it? Number two. I know this is a toughie. And I know it's going to potentially hurt feelings, but it needs to be said. Fear in the face of difficulties is a lack of faith. And I know that's a tough one to swallow, but I want you to consider something. In Matthew chapter 14, when Peter requests to come out of the boat and walk across the water to Jesus, and he begins to sink in the water, what does Jesus say to him? Oh, you of little faith. We need to make sure we think about this sometimes, folks. If this is something you struggle with, if this is something that's a perpetual problem for you, then maybe what you need to do is just kind of dig deeper into the issue and work on it. Because you need to have faith. You need to have a vibrant faith. A faith that really, if we're going to stretch the illustration, a faith that's willing to go with David and not taunt, torment, or tremble on the sides. Give this some thought. I don't know what the issue may be. It may be maybe many things. And I'll mention a few in a moment. It may be many things. It may be several of the ones I mentioned in a moment. But if fear is that overwhelming feature, then maybe we have a faith problem. And we need to give that some thought. Okay. Number three. See clearly the battle. I don't want you to leave with the impression that David was just young and naive. Oh, the boy just didn't know any better. You realize that's how Eliab treated him. You're just a runt. You don't even have any business being here. You just came to be a nuisance. Go back home to father's sheep, right? And David said, no. I recognize this. I see what's going on. I see how big this man is. But what everybody on Israel's side had forgotten was how big God was. And the young boy, he didn't forget. Why? Because he knew. He knew who God was. Keep in mind, at this point in David's life, there has been no perpetual generation promised to him. It's not like God told him at this point, David, by your loins, all the world's going to be blessed. By David, you're going to be the king forever. And David, you're going to have an everlasting kingdom. You realize none of those promises have happened yet. So it's not like David is, well, I was promised children and I haven't had children yet, so now I can trust in God. No. He trusted on the way God had always taken care of him. Get what I just said. He looked back at the way God had taken care of him in the past, and that gave him confidence in the future. This is not naive. He sees the same Goliath everyone else saw. But he saw God more clearly than anyone else did.
Number four. It kind of feeds out of that, doesn't it? We've got to trust God. Is that easy? I would imagine not. I don't imagine it was easy for David in some respects. Although Samuel gives us no indication that there's any hesitation. Samuel gives us no indication that David, as he's walking across the field, and now he's out of earshot, he's, oh, this was a really bad idea. I can't believe I did this, but I'm already out here now. We don't get any of that from David. David trusted. He looked at what God had done, and it gave him confidence for what God would do. We can't always know how God will work, but the fact that He will work should be good enough for us. I want you to think about that. We can't always know how God will work, but the fact that He will work should be good enough for us. It was for David. And then finally, there is no Goliath too great. Every person has those issues they struggle with. For some people, it's the same issue all the time. It's one temptation. It's one frustration, aggravation. Folks, there's a lot of reasons why we have David and Goliath here. There's a lot of reasons why we have 1 Samuel 17 in our Bibles. And I think that beyond the mesmerizing nature of the account, we need to make sure we see this. There are things in your life that tempt you to defy the living God. That's what Goliath is calling Israel on. I'm here. Your God's nothing. When David calls him on the carpet for it, that's what David says. You're not going to sit here and defy the armies of the living God. So I don't know what it is for you specifically. It may be discouragement. It may be some kind of a spiritual ache. It may be monetary, financial of sorts. Now, don't misunderstand me and think I'm promising you some kind of health and wealth thing. It may be something related to the congregation here. It may be something where you're concerned about the future, concerned about possibilities of new converts. It may be that you're struggling with thinking, how are you going to talk to that neighbor about their soul? It may be something in your marriage. You're struggling with some issue with your spouse, and there is this constant nagging problem where there is a disagreement, and there's issue, and there's trying to resolve those issues, and there's continual frustration and tension. It may be something to do with your children. It may be that a child is getting older and is at a point where they're making their own decisions. Or it may be they've already made their own decisions and they went into this world and it doesn't look like they're ever coming back. It may be that the children are still too young to have some of those problems. But what aches and what gnaws at you is what might happen to them. We all have our Goliaths. And some of them are much worse than others. And some of them are much more serious than others. And yet I think what we need to remember, folks, there is no Goliath bigger than God. Victory is absolute. It is certain. And the beautiful thing about victory is it encourages others. Do you find encouragement from David? 3,000 years later.
3,000 years later. And this wonderful event has shaped even cinema. The underdog. The February 1980 Olympics. The true David and Goliath stories. We're all facing Goliaths. In fact, in some respects, we're the underdog of our own story. Because sin is that monster across the valley. Too often, we welcome sin across the valley to reside in our tent with us. Sin is Goliath. It is that monstrosity that has slayed its thousands and wants to slay you. I want to tell you, and I'm going to tell you pretty plainly, you try to fight Goliath on your own, you're going to die. And yet, thankfully, this 9'6" miserable monster of the Philistines, he's not just threatening you, he's threatening you because you're God's. So what are you going to do about it? Well, you can lean into God, and he'll help you fight this battle. And that will secure your victory. It may be tonight that we've touched on some things that have been related to things in your life, that you've fought these fights before and you've lost and struggled. We want to help you. Everyone in this room is fighting a Goliath or has fought Goliaths. We just want to help you serve the Lord, man. Can we help you in some way tonight? We'd love to, if you're willing to come forward now as we stand and as we sing.